Hey, everyone, and welcome to God's Masters and Clout. Three things that, well, honestly, are a little bit more complicated than I originally knew when I started this podcast. First things first, I'm sorry about not posting more regularly. This year has been just as crazy as the last one is. And I'll get into the details of where I've been at lately when I do finally and eventually complete the next episode of the Fear Inoculant series. But one important thing that I did this last year was get into grad school, actually, something I never thought that I would be doing. I'm attending the social technologies program at Arizona State, and I'm really liking it so far, but I'm still also working full time. So to be honest with you, I don't know when the next episode, full episode, is going to come out. So I thought in the meantime, in this last semester, I wrote a few things that I thought, you know, maybe had some worth to them. Maybe the ideas were worth putting out there. I put them on my blog on caseyfranco.com that nobody really reads and I don't promote, but it makes me sleep better at night knowing, you know, maybe those will live on at least until the account that pays for that domain, you know, runs out of money and they disappear from the internet. But I also thought that as an end of the year sort of gift, maybe, or maybe just to make you feel like this subscription is a little bit worthwhile, I thought that I would record some of these papers in an audio format and give them the same God's Masters and Clout treatment that I've given the other episodes. So over the next month or so, before I leave the country once again, sorry, long story, won't get into it here, I'm going to try to record at least three of these and then release them here as bonus episodes. Sorry, long explanation for a very simple episode. So without further ado, here is bonus episode number one, a paper I wrote titled Occupy Wall Street Bets, Digital Revolutions, and Technological Constructivism. Please enjoy. To set the scene, it was the morning of January 27th, 2021, a very sunny day in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and I'll admit, I was anxious to witness a revolution. It was roughly 8 a.m. I had just sat down with my morning cup of coffee. My workspace was set as it always was, a MacBook Pro to my left running both the software I needed for my real job and a web browser logged in to Robinhood.com. To my right, an iPad open to the Reddit app, r/Wall Street Bets daily discussion post front and center, with a comment section set to automatically refresh every 5 seconds. This subreddit had become for me what a traditional day trader might have considered a ticker tape, albeit peppered more heavily with profanity. I, and millions of others like me, had only one thing on our minds that morning: a video game retailer that hadn't been significant to us for more than a decade. For the uninitiated, a few terms here need to be unraveled. From the top, starting with Robinhood. As the name suggests, Robinhood was devised as an online brokerage platform for the little guy. With no commissions on trades, availability on all smartphones, and a sleek user interface, it was my first choice for trading. One could feel free to invest modestly to their heart's content, aided by helpful information, real-time pricing, and for a small monthly subscription, access to trading on margin. This low barrier to entry meant it was the perfect tool for inexperienced traders. The year of its creation, it had roughly 500,000 users. In 2021, it had roughly 18 million. Most of these users were not your typical Wall Street patrons. They were your average Joes, your side hustlers, perhaps people you would see sitting at a slot machine on a trip to Las Vegas. As of December 27th, 2020, most of these users had received at least $600 thanks to the Consolidated Appropriations Act stimulus checks meant to offset financial worries due to the COVID-19 pandemic. For me, the pandemic uprooted my entire life, and $600 was not going to change that, so into my savings account it went. And I was not the only one, according to the comments I saw on r/Wall Street Bets. This will become important shortly. r/WallStreetBets is what's known as a subreddit or a forum within the broader and fabulously popular website reddit.com. Reddit stands currently on the shoulders of giants like dig.com and slashdot.com. By this I mean, although functions like allowing users to organize into communities based on shared interests and filtering user-submitted content based on a democratic voting system are powerful functions, they are not without precedent. Yet, despite the possible banality of its utilities, Reddit currently has 52 million daily active users. Roughly 1.7 million of these users were subscribed to r/WallStreetBets at the time of January 2021. At the time of writing, August 2021, WallStreetBets had garnered a whopping 10.8 million subscribers. Compare that to the self-reported 11 million client accounts boasted by a more traditional retail investing platform, TD Ameritrade, and you've got the beginnings of a trading paradigm shift. If communities of practice are collectives who, quote, share a concern or a passion for something they do and learn how to do it better as they interact regularly, then WallStreetBets was and is a community of practice built upon a framework of constant interaction revolved around a singular purpose, the acquisition of tendies, or WallStreetBets slang for chicken tenders. As humorous as this is, I find it illustrates the original pathos of the subreddit quite well. We are average people. We've seen how the volatility of the global market has meant financial ruin for millions and simultaneously consequence-free windfalls for hedge fund managers over the last couple decades. We want in on that fun, but we're not greedy. We don't want a yacht. We'll be satisfied with chicken tenders from McDonald's. Any further enjoyment will come from celebrating the gains and losses of our fellow WallStreetBets trader. Our favorite movie is Adam McKay's The Big Short, not Oliver Stone's Wall Street. Just like the brokers that we're mocking, we will risk financial ruin for ourselves. The difference is in the pursuit of only enough to purchase fast food. To us, this is no more absurd than the structure of the market itself. All value is relative, and my only allegiance is to my portfolio and my fellow Wall Street bettor. You only live once. Now, of course, this is not an actual quote. This is just my impression of the average WallStreetBets user after my two or so years of use. An association that began embarrassingly approximate to the market crash of March 2020. From March 2020 to January 2021, I felt sentiments towards the Federal Reserve, the United States government, and even the stock market in general change for the worse on WallStreetBets. While not rosy to begin with, the announcement of unlimited quantitative easing via the Federal Reserve in late March 2020 did not endear itself to the members of this community who took pride in their little guy label. What unlimited quantitative easing meant was the Federal Reserve committing to the purchase of long-term securities as a means to reinflate the crashed market, literally, no matter the cost. On the always sardonic WallStreetBets forum, this came to be represented by an animated GIF of Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell feverishly cranking dollar bills out of a handle-cranked printer. If we assume that the average age of a WallStreetBets subscriber paralleled the average age of a Robinhood user, then at 31 years old, an amateur trader witnessing the 2020 bailing out of the economy may have gotten flashbacks to the 2008 housing crash and subsequent stimulus and quantitative easing. At that time, the billions invested to save Wall Street instead of the victims of subprime loans sparked a mass movement called Occupy Wall Street, so named under the idea that if Wall Street can physically influence where we live, we can physically influence where they live. For many millennials, myself included, this represents a moment in time where the values of their governing state became abundantly clear. Now, there's much literature devoted to why Occupy Wall Street withered away. But what's clear is its sentiments lived on in the backs of the minds of average millennials as they went off to or finished college, crushed by student loan debt in a hegemonic ideology that tells them no forgiveness is coming for the responsibilities they took on themselves. Fiscal responsibility for thee and not for me. Fast forward now again to early January 2021. With Robinhood as the tool for practice and Reddit the tool for communication, Wall Street Bets had become a well-oiled machine. A decentralized, grassroots community of semi-professional and amateur investors, millions of users strong, and they knew it. In the weeks prior to the 27th, users on the subreddit had noticed something. Many large hedge funds had begun targeting older brick-and-mortar retailers for short sells as the market shifted to one less dependent on physical storefronts. Or in other words, Wall Street was betting on these traditional storefronts to fail. This created a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where, trusting one another's valuations, more and more hedge funds took short positions. This drove the stock price of the retailers further and further down, as a stock's price simply reflects what someone is willing to pay for it, not that stock's inherent value. One such retailer was GameStop. If we are to continue assuming the average age of a Wall Street Bets user, this particular storefront meant something. It represented a cultural mecca for a younger class of citizens that grew up in a time of perpetual budget cuts for social programs and infrastructure, while wealth inequality skyrocketed. It represented the good old days of our childhood, where a new game meant an escape from the outside world, a world that seemed radically more alienating and scary than the one our parents insisted was out there waiting for us. The 27th of January was the reckoning. The philosophy was as follows: we like the stock. In the same way that cumulative short speculation drives a stock price down, cumulative long speculation must drive a price up. Hedge funds take positions worth billions of dollars, but relatively few positions compared to the total volume of trades on a given stock. Users realized it's not the reputation of these agencies that drives the prices down, it's just the size of the positions. Therefore, in the same way that a few friends could get together and all buy themselves shares of a stock that just might perform poorly, communities using the internet could collectively decide to buy a stock together. Suddenly, individuals investing their spare change could be joined by millions of other like-minded investors doing the same. This realization created what can maybe be seen as the world's first crowdsourced hedge fund. By joining together and buying the quote-unquote artificially low price of a share of GameStop, which was $3 in early January 2021, due to the speculative nature of the market, the price must go up as people are willing to pay more for the stock. What made the 27th so notable was its proximity to the expiration date on many short positions for large hedge funds. Should the price of the stock rise high enough, many of these positions would expire worthless, meaning huge losses for the hedge funds that bet against them, and, as Wall Street Bets theorized, huge spikes in value for the stock as these negative positions disappeared and had to be covered by the hedge funds. Thus, Wall Street Bets set out to quote-unquote short squeeze GME, the ticker symbol for GameStop, from the clutches of Wall Street. On the morning of the 27th, the price for a single share of GameStop was $347.51, an increase of more than 11,000% in roughly a month. One particular hedge fund singled out by Wall Street Bets, Melvin Capital, was forced to cancel their positions, netting a loss of nearly $7 billion over the course of the next week. Now, it never fully went under, but to this day, it has not recovered. So, mission accomplished? Now, on the other hand, GameStop has yet to reach the same high it did on January 27th, and thus, many people who joined in the fight are still holding their shares of GameStop, waiting for financial revolutionary sentiment to hit a fever pitch once more. For the price of a share of GameStop, an old friend, one could join in a fully digitalized revolution that was realizing the dream of Occupy Wall Street, showing Wall Street that there were power in numbers. However, unlike the original Occupy Wall Street movement, The Wall Street Bets versus Melvin Capital saga burned faster, brighter, and hotter. Its results were not simply psychic, they were tangible. Like Occupy Wall Street, it's hard to decide exactly whether or not this movement could be considered a success, or whether it was even a movement to begin with. However, in the minds of millions who were watching and participating, this digital revolution provided a valuable lesson about democracy and collectivity. So what further lessons can we derive from the Wall Street Bets saga? Because of the moralistic, Hollywood-esque, underdog versus big bully themes of the story, it can be hard to quantify the technological structures that underpin it all. At its heart, it's a continuation of the story of techno-democratization that has been unfolding since the internet was invented. It's a story that begs questions regarding the definition of democracy itself, and even deeper, what it means to act in an autonomous and non-coerced manner, what it means to be free. Famously, Wall Street mocked Occupy Wall Street. CNBC still respects the name Wall Street Bets almost a year later. One of the crucial differences between these two movements were the tools at their disposal. Occupy Wall Street consisted of an occupation of New York's financial district, but had scarce doctrine beyond that. Their communication was based largely around Twitter, but was decentralized and unguided. Their only tool for nonviolent practice was their bodies and maybe a hashtag or two. Hashtags are not particularly useful revolutionary tools, and one's own body is technically a tool for protest, but it's a tool with high collateral potential. Compare this to the tools at Wall Street Bet's disposal. Their emotional fuel was exactly the same, a revulsion to the hypocrisy of market and state values, but they were singular in their battle plan due to their communication through Reddit. They were a community of practice, not necessarily people piggybacking on a hashtag. Their weapons for change were smartphones and tablets, not Molotov cocktails. And the same government that they saw as the harbinger of an artificially inflated economy had just gifted them $600. Not enough to severely help with rent, but perhaps enough for a couple shares of GameStop? Neither Reddit nor Robinhood, despite what their marketing material might suggest, were designed to be revolutionary tools. They both exist very comfortably within the status quo they claim to be disrupting. While built for the inexperienced, downwardly mobile retail investor, Robinhood still helps perpetuate the same market economy that perhaps also necessitates an investor's need to gamble on stocks for a chance at a taste of the good life. Robinhood, within its proper context, is not the technological guillotine it pretends to be. It's a slot machine with really low odds. And like all slot machines, it's designed to keep a person in their seat. Reddit, while claiming to be built on a democratic voting system, is still a platform. It's still a platform built upon architectures of particular uses and algorithms of content filtering, all owned by the same private organization. It will always contain some level of content bias by nature. Let's say, for instance, a group decided to create a staunchly anti-Reddit subreddit, one devoted to the dissolving of Reddit as a corporation at any cost. How long would Reddit allow them to carry on if such a subreddit were to garner large-scale attention? Now, r/anti_Reddit does exist, but with its 41 members, I suspect it's more valuable to Reddit's ideals of freedom of speech to live and let live. Here we should keep in mind that on February 18th, 2021, just a couple weeks after the Wall Street Bets versus Melvin Capital saga, Reddit CEO Steve Huffman was forced to provide a statement in front of Congress to the House Committee on Financial Services to distance the website as a whole from the actions of its subreddit, Wall Street Bets. Quote, "Reddit's mission is to bring community and belonging to everyone in the world," is how his statement began. His following statement was a boast regarding the success of r/unemployment. And don't just take my word for it.
Madam Chairwoman, Mr. Ranking Member, honorable members of the committee, my name is Steve Huffman. I am the co-founder and CEO of Reddit, and I'm pleased to talk with you today about how Reddit works and what we have seen on our site in the past few weeks. Reddit's mission is to bring community and belonging to everyone in the world. What started in 2005 as a single community has since evolved into a vast network of many thousands of communities. They range from standard topics like news, sports, politics, to internet culture, to support. For example, our unemployment community has become a source of support for hundreds of thousands of Americans who have turned to Reddit after losing their jobs during the pandemic.
To me, there is no better illustration of our moment in history than the CEO of a techno-democratic community platform bragging to a governing body about the membership size of its unemployment support groups in an attempt to defend against accusations of market manipulation, all the while neither party realizing the deeply sad irony of the situation. Just going through the motions of throwing our hands up and say, oh, who could have predicted this? How could we ever have known that those savages on our website would have done something like this? It's not our fault. As if to say, how could you accuse us of defrauding Wall Street? Look how many unemployed people we've connected. These radically improvised uses for both Reddit and Robinhood, to me, are proof that our societies are not technologically determinant, which is to say that our societies are not directed by the technology that they invent. Both of these platforms, Reddit and Robinhood, came about in full synchronicity with and in full support of the status quo. As soon as their uses were recontextualized, those new uses warranted apologies and official statements. They were met with cries of market manipulation and other such reaction, the likes of which I'd expect from sour video game developers watching speedrun compilations of their games. While it's possible, the game was not designed to be played in this manner, and it will need to be patched, so to speak. Can a website ever claim to be fully democratic? Is the internet itself inherently democratic? If democracy can be simplified as the sovereignty of the will of the majority, this necessitates a sovereign governing agency to carry out that will. In a neutral framework, the internet might possibly function like a decentralized library or a series of virtual intentional communes, but the internet is democratic, not anarchistic. This means that so long as there's a starched dichotomy between creating and consuming bodies online, the vacuums created by the desires of mass-consuming bodies will necessitate platforms with greater power than they to interpret and fill those desires, kind of like a cyberpunk Rousseauian general will. But the internet does not exist in a vacuum. It was not discovered underground. It did not crash on Earth via an asteroid. It rose up as a reflection of the society that built it. Cyberspace and meat space are not two independent dimensions. An adoption of something like a digital monism, or perhaps more aptly, a digital dialectical materialism, gives us a much clearer view of how our present moment shapes online occurrences and vice versa. The internet, like a nation state, consists of many individual nodes with their own goals and wills and connections to other nodes. As time goes on, the will of these individual nodes is necessarily expressed. This will is an inherent need to change one's own environment. In life, this is work and travel and combating entropy, etc. Online, this is data creation and data consumption along the lines of an ever-shifting architecture. One does not buy a computer for it to just sit idle, just as one does not remain fully sedentary even while sleeping. To be online is to generate data through action, just as to be alive is to create lacks and needs. Online, an action doesn't derive meaning from within a single node. Instead, an action derives its meaning from the nature of the connection between it and another node. And there is no internet without connection. As we see in Hegelian philosophy, wherever there is two, we must evaluate hierarchy. The nature of the relationship of two nodes is not determined by the connection itself. It's determined by the architecture that enables that connection. What of yours may I access, and what of mine can you? And what permissions would I need to change these terms? For instance, due to the manner in which Amazon.com is designed, I, as a regular average visitor to the site, have no means of contacting or authoring a deal between myself and the server, which could result in money flowing from Amazon to myself. Due to the design of the website, I likely wouldn't even consider such an action from their homepage. However, such an interaction between myself and Amazon's server would be theoretically possible. That possibility is simply not embodied anywhere within the architecture of our connection. Both myself and the server are connected, but the monetary potential of our interactions flows only in one direction due to the architecture of the site. Now, this is a very obvious example, but on some level, this idea can be applied to any form of architecture. It's not that the design itself is inherently political. It's that the design's uses take on a political dimension when laid against the backdrop of the society it rose up from. The politics of technology, or as Langdon Winner phrased it, the politics of artifacts, functions a lot like a lens. If we see social change as sort of emanating from the society that we're in, technology and artifacts refract and hone those social changes. Technology is built with inherent implications. For instance, an Iron Maiden, the torture device, not the band, an Iron Maiden in the 1700s struck fear into the hearts of those who were aware of their existence. They likely kept some people from breaking laws just out of fear that they might end up in a castle dungeon face to face with one. Nowadays, people pay money to get inside a castle for a chance to see an Iron Maiden up close. The design is exactly the same, but the society has evolved around it, and its once seemingly inherent fear has become a simple commodity. Inherent to design is the ideology of the designer, whether or not they are consciously aware of it. As psychoanalysis has illustrated since its founding, not even individuals are in control of their own ideologies. Now, while this could be used as an argument for technological determinism, i.e. technology provides our lives with suggested meanings where we cannot fully conceive of our own, it is our society which changes the meanings of our meanings, depending on the context we find ourselves in. Good design seems to cause the tools of practice to fade away out of our view. As Martin Heidegger described it, when a hammer is functional, it becomes simply an extension of the arm and ready at hand. It's only when the hammer breaks that we notice it, present at hand. What this implies is a kind of waking hypnosis, where well-designed technology becomes a conduit for our will to change our environments to flow through us unobstructed. This puts an incredible emphasis on what creates our wills. In his book, The Whale in the Reactor, Langdon Winner states, quote, "Technologies are not merely aids to human activity, but also powerful forces acting to reshape that activity and its meaning. There's a cyclical nature between humans' willingness to shape their environments and their environment's effects on shaping human will." I've not been able to find who the quote is attributed to, but the phrase that best illustrates this point to me is, quote, "To herd cats, tilt the floor." When one's only tool is a hammer, the world seems made of nails. And when that hammer is well designed, we feel as though we are the hammer. There seems to be a contradiction between democratic values and a system of commodification underlying the internet today. Since this was not always the nature of the internet, it follows that it must have been influenced at some time from an external force. You know, it's not a known fact, but up until about 1995, it was illegal to advertise anything on the internet. This susceptibility to influence by external forces is not specific to the internet. It's inherent to technology itself. A piece of technology is designed with a use in mind. It's designed to solve a societal problem. Societal problems are deemed as such by society or our existential experiences at large. Which came first, human subjugation of fire or the problem of hunger, the overpriced commodity or the social construction of trade itself? We languish over our addiction to our smartphones and screens as if chained to them by some alien race. When we buy a stock, there is a Rube Goldberg machine's worth of ideological apparatuses under our action that shape the way we perceive the transaction as fair. I use a dollar, which derives its value from exchange value. It's a material object constructed to transcendentally stand in for any alternative object of human desire. I use it to buy a stock, a virtual object, the value of which reflects confidence in a particular corporation. When I view this transaction as just, I accept the corporation itself as a valid entity, the stock as a valid unit of measurement, and not only the dollar as a stand-in for desire, but the desire that it's standing in for as well. When I buy a stock, I'm betting either on a corporation's will being expressed within the hegemony of the society I find myself in, or against its will being expressed in the hegemony of the society I find myself in. Inherent in my bet is a trust in the market system that enables the corporation whose stock I'm purchasing, the platform which authorizes me to purchase said asset, even the society which has created the terminal through which I order my transaction, a computer which, as of the most recent models, includes a biometric finger scanning device in order to more safely authorize transactions. What if it's the way in which society is constructed that has necessitated my playing of these games, the creation of these slot machines, and the tilting of these floors? When Wall Street Bets comes together to get rich while getting revenge, they're not necessarily behaving of their own volition. They've been guided here by the same system that has guided their perceived enemies to this moment in time through the very architecture they both exist in. It's the same architecture that allows them to utilize collectively what the hedge funds utilize with large reserves. By getting down into the mud with the hedge funds, they accept the swamp as fact. Perhaps this is what the Wall Street Bets GameStop micro-revolution failed to grasp, the contradiction that led to the dissolution of the sentiment for change. It was never really about the tendies. It wasn't even fully about getting revenge on the colossal financial apparatuses that gambled away their futures on intangible assets they'd never see the benefits from. It was about finding their next meal. It was about finding meaning. It was about participating in a community that seemed to truly celebrate them and their being alive, even when it led to financial ruin. Members of the forum were more than simply acquaintances. Unlike the society outside of their basements that seemed to only value them so far as it could extract value from them, their fellow Wall Street Bets comrades were helping them build financial capital and social capital for themselves by doing nothing more than sharing jokes, financial woes, and which stock they were thinking of buying next. Ask yourself why the measure of success in the early days of cryptocurrency was whether or not one had held long enough to afford a Lamborghini. It's because the imported car is a status symbol. It commands respect, but only within the hegemony. It gives identity where none can otherwise be found outside of a community that genuinely cares for one another. That is, I think, what the Wall Street bettors were really seeking in the world and found amongst themselves. That's why Lambos were replaced with Tendies. Wall Street Bets only asked for the bare minimum, but failed to see the world around them that required them to ask. So enamored by their reversal of the tools given to them by the status quo were they that they failed to see that total victory would mean becoming exactly what they fought against. They banded together to become a decentralized hedge fund and sanctified the hedge fund model in the process. In organized sports, upsets can happen, but the outcome of a single game will never dismantle the league. The denizens of Wall Street Bets found themselves at the blackjack table of online retail brokerages, cards ready at hand. They saw the house that had taken all of their chips now on the verge of busting. Their only course of action was to hit. An alternative could not even be conceived. In that instant, they won the hand, but in their ecstasy, forgot that they were still inside the casino.